Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Yu Yun Zhan, and today we will talk about Korea-China relations with a focus on semiconductors and what they mean for Europe. This podcast is part of Zhonghua Mundus, our series about global China as seen from Europe. It comes out each month along with our China newsletter under the same name. The link to subscribe is in the show notes. As usual, I am with our senior fellow, Alicia Garcia Herrero. Hi, Alicia, how are you?
All fine, thank you.
And I'm also happy to have with us today Dr. Jun Park, who is a South Korean political economist working on geopolitical risks and emerging technologies. She serves as a visiting fellow at the Middle East Council on Global Affairs and also an expert principal investigator and convener of the Emerging Technology Workshops for a multiple-year project for the Small States Research Program at Georgetown University in Qatar. Jun, welcome to The Sound of Economics.
Thank you for inviting me.
Alicia, why don't you kick us off with some state of play of Korea-China economic relations?
Sure. So first of all, Jun, it's such a pleasure to have you here. I know this is going to be very interesting. So let me just start very briefly on what to me is kind of a very dual, if I may say, or very, you know, strange situation for Korea to maintain. But quite amazingly, Korea is indeed maintaining this very close economic linkage with China. And I'll give a few numbers now. And then on the other hand, an increasing awareness of the potential rivalry, I would say competition, surely, economically speaking, in third markets, but also rivalry, and in a way, potentially even a threat, because we need to discuss a little bit about Taiwan and what it means to South Korea. So, you know, all of these things together are hard to manage. So on the economic side, South Korea is very much interlinked with China, I would say more than Japan. And you have first of all, China is the largest trading partner by far, with 26% of Korea's total exports and 21% of Korea's imports, which means Korea has a big trade surplus with China. And by the way, this is quite exceptional because hardly anybody does. Yeah. So Taiwan is another big case, and with South Korea. So, you know, to me, the interesting thing for us to discuss is also your view on whether Yoon Suk-yeol is really a turning point or is just one of the very many changes, yeah, in terms of South Korea's policy towards China. So he's well known to have followed a carrots and stick approach. So on the one hand, imagine just attending the NATO summit in Madrid. I mean, that's a big thing if you think about where South Korea is with Japan, the trilateral agreement with the US with Japan. But at the same time, though, economic relations continue. South Korea is not in the chip agreement with the Netherlands and Japan. So, you know, you see, like, in a way, protecting that economic relation. So for me, the question really, and I'm not supposed to ask questions, but Jun, I'm going beyond my role today because I'm really interested in Jun's responses to this dilemma that South Korea is going through. So that was all from my side.
Thank you so much for that, Alicia. So I think naturally our conversation now goes to Jun. Jun, could you tell us how did Korea become a semiconductor powerhouse?
Well, before Korea became what it is today in terms of a major exporter in the global economy, I think much of the attribution should be to the semiconductor industry. But Korea was not essentially a major player from the beginning. The 1986 U.S.-Japan Semiconductor Agreement was one of the critical catalysts toward Taiwan and South Korea becoming major players, South Korea especially in the memory chip realm. Because at the time, Japan was accused of dumping DRAMs on the U.S. market, and the U.S. took actions to prevent the Japanese from doing so. And in due course, South Korea and Taiwan were left in the competition with more opportunities to perform on the chips scene. The breakthrough for Samsung was through the NAND flash provision for iPod Nano for Apple in 2006. Since then, Samsung has tried, especially on talent acquisition, development, continuous investment into R&D, SK Hynix, as of late, more on high bandwidth memory chips in accordance with AI chips. But the main focus for Samsung and SK Hynix, both companies, they are on memory chips. And when it comes to China, the real question, as Alicia mentioned, is that the exports have been completely reliant on China. Because in 2022, 55% of Korea's semiconductor exports went to China. And in the third quarter of 2022, SK Hynix and Samsung made each 25% and 10% of their revenue, respectively, in China. And the real question going forward is about their foundry operations in China. They produce roughly around 40%, and the two firms together produce roughly around 40% of their memory chips in China. And in SK Hynix's case, over 40% of the DRAM chips, they are produced in a facility in Wuxi, and it was expanded in 2019. They also purchased NAND facilities in Dalian from Intel when Intel was about to put it on the market. It was roughly around 10 billion transaction, and SK Hynix has not fulfilled the payment yet. Samsung's facilities in Xi'an, they were also expanded several times. And in 2022, it was in a total investment of about 25 billion US dollars. And NAND flash memory chips, they are mostly produced there in Xi'an. So noting that Samsung produces semiconductors in the memory chip realm, followed by Samsung and SK Hynix, the real competitor that's left is the US company Micron. And what's important now is depending on the US chip export control guidelines and the Chips and Science Act subsidy provision, what kind of conditions these companies will have to embrace in order to continue their operations in China. And I think that what we mentioned as the Japan-Dutch-US agreement, it's a little bit different in the case of these producers, in the sense that the Dutch and the Japanese, the export controls imposed on them, they're mainly about equipment. But Samsung and SK Hynix, they're the ones that need to buy equipment to produce in China and to expand in China. So there's a little bit of difference there. And the competition with US companies are also a little bit different in the dynamics. I would just note that.
Alicia, do you want to come back to that?
Yes. So basically, I think, Jun, you've described what's the competitive landscape of your semiconductor industry. What I think we should do now is to put this into what this means for South Korea's relations with China. So if I hear you correctly, I mean, the story really is about, to me, okay, and let me know if I'm reading you wrongly, but to put it geopolitically, your companies, your semiconductor companies, have made a bet to me very clearly, and this is not very different from Taiwan, to be frank, that the market is in the US. I mean to say, not the market, the way to survive, because you need to move up the ladder to really be that ecosystem in the AI revolution, etc., will allow you to run in this revolution. So yes, China's market is huge, but you cannot do without the US, because you simply would become one more, quote unquote, China semiconductor company eventually, because that's the link that makes you special. And because of that, yes, you're not in this trilateral export control agreement, but you have other constraints. You know, they may be different, but you have other constraints. So how is China taking this? Because, you know, the point is they probably see you as also moving away somehow. And I'm sure they realize that you're probably their only hope, because the rest are very much even more contained. And I would say Taiwan, for other reasons, they're also not in that agreement, but they're surely extremely watched. And we saw some cases also related to exports to Russia from Taiwan, which, you know, were very scary for Taiwanese semiconductor producers. So how is South Korea dealing with this situation, this sandwich situation where, yes, you are in a different sandwich as the Netherlands, but you are in a sandwich as well? how can you continue to have a business relation with China in these circumstances?
The business relationship, I think, in the chips realm, mainly the two editions of the export controls, the October 7, 2022 export controls, that was the real wake-up call with regard to doing continued chip fabrication in China. And the long-awaited decision after 1 year post October 7, 2022, came in October 2023 when South Korea's Samsung and SK Hynix received something called VEU status from the US government. It's essentially a VEU status, meaning verified end user. So in the beginning, there were exit plans that were envisioned by Samsung and SK Hynix because there was no clear guideline as to whether expansion would be allowed or upgrading would be allowed. And the South Korean government, Ministry of Trade, Industry and Economy, lobbied very hard in Washington in order to receive some kind of answer as to whether expansion would be allowed and whether upgrading would be allowed. And in this sense, two major things come into question. At the end of the day, October 7, 2022 controls, they ended with VEUs being given out to Samsung and SK Hynix. So for indefinite renewals with U.S. semiconductor equipment going into those foundries, it is allowed. But as we know, in the chip industry, expansion of the facilities are essential because of additional equipment that's completely new going into these foundries. And in the Chips and Science Act guardrails, the Commerce Department did not move an inch regarding the limitations in expansion. So, for instance, for legacy nodes, not more than 10% of the current capacity and not more than 5% for advanced nodes for current capacity for operations in China. So you could say that, yes, there is an indefinite upgrading allowed in terms of putting the new U.S. semiconductor equipment into those facilities, but at the same time, you cannot expand. So things are still in question in terms of the operations in China for South Korean companies.
Yeah, and I noticed that Korea saw its first trade deficit with China in nearly three decades. South Korea's exports to China has fallen 20% in 2023, and the imports from China also decreased 8%. So maybe could you elaborate a bit on this, and then does semiconductor industry play a big role in this?
I think that the significant decrease in the exports, they were critical to the overall GDP in South Korea in the previous couple of years because mainly having to do with what I explained earlier about China become the main export destination for South Korea for chips. And when the Chinese economy was dwindling, South Korea got hit directly because there was not enough consumption from the Chinese side. At the same time, I think in the longer run, if Chinese companies decide to propel more towards legacy chips or try to go more domestic producer oriented in terms of fabrication, even if it is not completely advanced node, there is a chance that similar things might happen in terms of what happened in the LCD market. So, for instance, LG is selling LCD factories to China, Chinese players, because of concentration on their willingness to concentrate on OLED. But at the same time, what it means is with time, some of these factories will be sold to Chinese companies. And the same might happen if Samsung and SK Hynix cannot keep on upgrading and expanding. So there is a real question there.
Alicia, do you want to come back to this?
Yes. I mean, South Korea has enjoyed a big surplus until very recently. We're talking like literally 2023. Interestingly, though, the economy in China grew literally nearly double 2022. So I actually don't think it's a question of demand. I mean, I hear you, June, because that's the usual explanation. But if you think about it as an economist, there has to be something else. And I think you pointed out to that something else, because it's really China's localization policy. Yeah, it's basically China asking its consumers to consume Chinese chips in this case, or, you know, legacy chips, at least those that China can produce, and beyond. And it's also, in a way, asking, and this is very important, South Korean or any other foreign company to localize in China. So you basically produce in China, and therefore you don't need to import, because the localization policies for China oblige foreign companies to reduce their imports, basically not to use external suppliers, foreign suppliers, and to use domestic suppliers. So a lot of what's happening, in my opinion, okay, in your figures, is going to be structural, because there's no way return from localization. Once you've localized, you've lost your suppliers. And interestingly, and this is just to me a rather superficial way to look at things, is that most people think the fall in exports from South Korea, or also Taiwan, same thing, is, of course, there was the chip cycle being very negative in 2023. Also for Taiwan, exports collapsed double digit. But we think it's just a cycle, or sometimes we think it's export controls from the US. But to me, a lot is happening in China. Localization. I mean, they're changing the model. So if it's more the second than the former, there's no way back. The exports will grow. They're growing in South Korea now, but to the US, because this is where the AI revolution is happening. So a lot of the recovery will no longer be thanks to China. This can have big implications in terms of South Korea's, you know, objectives. Yeah, it's like for a long time, it was all about China economically, because it was giving so much to South Korea. But if this changes now, and you have to be localized, and you know that localization, as you said, is constrained by the US because you cannot increase the operations. In a way, this is then unavoidable, that the relations are going to be less strong, economically speaking. And I wonder, is this what you're seeing? Is this what you're seeing?
At least for now, I think under the current climate, especially on exports, I think that is the case. And I agree with you wholeheartedly on the US market. The current memory chip sales to AI-related companies, I think mainly having to do with the high bandwidth memory chips that accompany GPUs, NVIDIA's GPUs. I think that's the main growth point for both companies, although SK Hynix is a little bit ahead of Samsung on this. Going forward, I think that still both companies will try to wait out a little bit on how the Chips and Science Act subsidies are provided, because SK Hynix has not completely decided on which state to build their testing and packaging plant. Samsung is, in addition to the Austin Semiconductor in Texas, they're trying to build another one in Taylor, Texas, adjacent to the Austin one. But there have been no clear indication from the U.S. government on how much subsidies would be provided. And that's kind of crucial, not only to these two companies, but also to TSMC. And I think that's one of the reasons why companies like TSMC are eyeing elsewhere outside the US. So Japan, Germany, these locations. And into the coming years, I think that we still have a very fluid situation on how the market will evolve. I can't bet 100% on South Korean companies going to the US, relying completely on the US into the future, because competition will arise even within the U.S. market, and there is no guarantee that expansion in the U.S. In terms of operation would come into reality at this rate under the current political climate. End products exports may increase, I think, but in terms of, you know, completely moving operations to the U.S. or doing advanced nodes in the U.S., I don't think that's really something that's realistic.
And how does the EU play a role in all of this? Like, does the EU have a big relations with Korea in terms of semiconductor? And then is Korea also trying to diversify its supply chain to have more markets in the EU? Could you also tell us a bit more about that?
I think the EU has also come up with its own chip subsidy policies just to rear some national champion, well, regional champions within the bloc. For South Korea, the main node of cooperation is with countries like Belgium for the chemicals and also with the Netherlands for EUV equipment, lithography equipment for chip fabrication, especially with ASML. And ASML, by far, is the dominant player in the EUV lithography. I think that originally there were some intense invitations from the Dutch side to, not just the Dutch, but also the German side, to come and build foundries in Europe. But I think both for Samsung and SK Hynix, the crucial factor to consider is whether there is an ecosystem and whether there is a market in addition to the kinds of considerations for large-scale production. And at the moment, the EU does not promise that in other than auto chips. Although I would say within a decade or two, the EU countries' economies would embrace the AI revolution and chips will be in demand significantly. So I see that the cooperation is occurring more in South Korea with EU countries coming to Korea to participate in the K-chip clusters, say, for instance, ASML participating in the K-chip cluster by Samsung and SK Hynix, Yongin clusters expansion, and including their equipment for further sales, and also ASML pitching in to build the centers for repairing the equipment within those clusters. So this is a big development. There's even a cooperation scheme between the Netherlands and South Korea. And they've been having rounds of events and dialogues on their cooperation on chips. So I think in the coming years, there will be more EU and South Korea related chip developments.
Alicia, do you want to comment on this?
Yes. So I think I'd fully agree with June. Our model, our chip-related economic relations with South Korea are very much export lithography machines, extreme ultraviolet light machines in particular, because that's basically what South Korea, first of all, because ASML is a monopoly in this, and secondly, because this is what is making South Korea kind of follow the AI revolution, you know, in the sense that it's in a way, it's more like helping South Korea compete with Taiwan, which is also doing the same, become a global player in these very, very advanced chips. But Europe is not yet on the demand side of these chips. And therefore, you know, why produce in Europe? You can export the machines. That's kind of the idea so far. I think there are a couple of things that may change this. It's already changing for Taiwan, so TSMC in Germany, but also other companies that serve TSMC in a way, MediaTek has been in Europe for much longer. And I think the Taiwan's chip manufacturers' idea is that the demand will be huge everywhere. I mean, they are betting, basically, June, on what you're saying from now. They realize that a region like Europe, I mean, at the end of the day, this is, in terms of economic size, the size of China. Of course, the sectoral specialization is different, and therefore there's no need for these advanced chips now. But of course, you know, if you think in 5 years, there's many, many things that are happening in Europe that for sure guarantee there will be demand. And this is, I think, if you look at quantum, I think the difference is probably that the Taiwanese have more constraints. They have water constraints, they have energy constraints. So in a way, they are pushed faster than South Korean chip manufacturers are. And to me, this might end up being their comparative advantage, because they might be earlier in other areas, and then it might be very hard to, why make this huge capex investment if there's already somebody there? You know, like, so I'm not trying to convince you, June, to come to Europe, because, you know, you are a researcher like me, but I'm just making this point that somehow people are looking at Europe today, auto chips, you know, this is legacy chips in many cases. So, but I think it's unavoidable that Europe will go through AI revolution. Actually, if you look at everywhere, I mean, in Europe, Germany plan for AI, everybody's working. So because it takes so long actually to fab chips anywhere, I just think that either it may happen very soon that there will be announcements. I can only tell you, like, in the case of Spain, there was basically the prime minister visiting Seoul. This was 2 years ago, just to convince Samsung, you know. So I know Europeans are trying very hard because they know this is going to be needed. But I understand that probably South Korean chip makers think, oh, I have the comparative advantage here. I have my ecosystem. I can just export. But the winds globally blow into localization. You know, like China's model, rightly or wrongly, is being exported. Yeah, many others say industrial policy, you come here or nothing, you localize or nothing. And now, of course, Europeans have no choice because nobody's localized in Europe. But as long as the Taiwanese start coming, I think that creates a different proposition, jobs, ecosystems, you know, subsidies, etc. So I think you're right, but I just wonder whether this might change soon because of this different approach for Taiwan so far, which is, of course, not yet full. I agree that it's just starting, but I think that's the direction.
Do you agree with that, June?
My major concerns about Europe in terms of the digital transformation is about the stringent GDPR and also the subsidies that so far I do not have confirmation from government and media reports on the subsidies given out to TSMC. I think Intel, Magdeburg, I think that one's finalized, but TSMC, I'm not quite sure exactly how much they are receiving. And if, say, for instance, the subsidies come into realization and TSMC is able to build, the next question would be about acquiring talent. And the same kind of questions were arisen in the U.S., especially regarding their Arizona plant. And I think that TSMC is very, very interested in building more in Japan because of the previous ecosystem that they had, or the talent and the culture, work culture, comparatively to what has been happening in Arizona. Because first of all, the American workforce is not equipped to run these foundries. And in order to make those foundries work, the US will have to issue engineer visas to Taiwan. I wonder if the same thing will happen in the German context, not just Germany, but also in France, in Grenoble. I think they're also doing, with the chip subsidies from the EU, I think they're doing another legacy plant. So into the coming years, the fabrication capacity in Europe, coupled with the stringent data laws, in addition to the EU AI Act, this is a bigger context of the innovation environment is what I fear in terms of the European case.
Alicia, do you think Europe has an innovation constraint?
Well, I hear you on constraints from Europe. I frankly think that this is not going to be only Europe. I think these constraints are going to become much more global. My sense of what may happen elsewhere is that the AI revolution will be constrained in a way. It's not it globally, certainly in the West. And therefore, I just, I think that that difference that rightly so you're discussing in terms of, you know, ability to develop fast will be less pronounced than we think it is now for many reasons, from ethical reasons. So that's the one side of the story. Secondly, Japan's demand is not comparable to Europe, and Japan cannot export its fabs to the world because then you may as well just stay in South Korea. You see what I mean? It's different. For Japan, it's a production capacity constraint that can help you with, in the case of Taiwan, water, energy, etc. But it's not a demand story. So demand story is you may want to, go to, a fast growing, say, Africa. I mean, in 20 years, you should be there. But the point is you won't go tomorrow, but you would go tomorrow to Europe. So I still think that. And on the engineers, my sense is that even at TSMC, there are people who think that that's not the most relevant constraint. Others don't, because, as you know, shareholders penalized TSMC because of Arizona. We had a change in leadership. The CEO, Mark Liu, left, and many people thought he had gone too far. But the reality is that if you're not in the US with the AI revolution, you're dead. So no matter the cost of the engineers. You see, I think we are putting a lot of, rightly so, this industry is based on costs, and people focus on that. But we're in a revolution. If you don't upscale, you move up the ladder, you are in the highest end, you may not survive, because China will compete with you in everything else with the legacy chips. So, the only thing you can do is upscale. And to upscale, you need to be close to NVIDIA, you need to be in the ecosystem. You're right, Europe doesn't have that ecosystem. That's the key. It only may have the demand, but not the ecosystem. So in that regard, I fully agree compared to the US, but I do not fully agree compared with Japan. So it's like a second, third best, if you may, but it's not like the last bet. And because these companies will need to expand, because they won't be able to provide chips for all of the demand in the world. It's impossible. Yeah, from a single entry point. I think they will become multinationals. So South Korean chip multinationals, Taiwanese chip multinationals. What this means, though, is for China, because this is about South Korea and China relations, is that unless you want to become a multinational in China, and there you have US constraints, it's very hard to play this game, because all of the other chips will be substituted. So I expect South Korea-China economic relations, trade-wise, to go down, same as happened with Taiwan. And South Korea-US economic relations, trade relations, to go up. And it's not geopolitical. What I want to end saying is, you may partially, the export controls, but it's mostly about the AI revolution. It's mostly about a technological breakthrough that is changing trade patterns. And I think this is something we cannot underestimate down the road. It's a big, big change. And this also has implications, of course, for foreign policy in South Korea. This is what I wanted to say, but you are the South Korea expert. I'm just telling you how I read, what's going on, and I'd like to hear your views. And just to close,
I agree totally on the impact of the AI revolution. I think that the geopolitical landscape may be a little bit hazy. We don't know what to expect in the coming election in the US, presidential election in the US. Things are still up in the air. What I do fear, though, is into the coming years, as the AI revolution progresses, I wonder whether the new kind of chips, neuromorphic chips, that would require significant amount of investment and participation by these companies, whether those kinds of startups would also face export controls, which may alter the direction of these new startups. Because I think that the AI revolution requires chips that are beyond GPUs.
Yeah.
And HBMs. So into the coming years, I think what we as analysts would need to pay attention to is how AI chips are formulated in-house or through a consortium, as proposed by OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, or Masayoshi Son through his project Izanagi. So in essence, I think the current the level of competition that the semiconductor industry has been manifesting for the past 2-3 decades, I think that would be altered through the AI revolution. But in what means and under what kind of regulations, I am not completely sure under what kind of political climate. The Taiwan question, whether the Silicon Shield Act question, I think that's still pretty much existing. But if TSMC succeeds in trying to diversify its locations, although I sincerely doubt that their 2-nano fabrication would be conducted outside Taiwan, perhaps some of those tensions would dissipate.
Thank you very much both for this interesting discussion, and I'm sure we'll come back to it since the AI revolution is really the topic of the future. For our listeners, you can always find our research at Bruegel.org. I am here with Senior Fellow from Bruegel, Alicia Garcia Herrero, and also June Park from the Middle East Council on Global Affairs. Thank you again for joining, and until next time, bye-bye.